The second part of the title of your latest book, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country, was what immediately caught my eye. The American public is used to pointing fingers at everyone, excluding the government, but rarely does it point its fingers and accept responsibility for its own actions. And your book is clearly designed to make its readers do just that.
Well, yes. The specific subject of the book is the relationship between the military and society. And we know we live at a time when supporting the troops really has kind of become the central tenet of our civil religion. It's something to which all Americans subscribe. But the argument I try to make in the book is that that support of the troops tends to be mostly symbolic. Then when it comes to substance, we actually hang the troops out to dry. And what I mean by that is that by having disengaged from our military, and in a sense disengaging from war, we have turned the army and war over to the state. And the state has used the military recklessly, and basically we the people have stood by and allowed that to happen.
One of the most thought-provoking sections is that part you devote to the replacement of what, until the middle of the Vietnam War, had been largely a citizen-soldier army with an all-volunteer force, and how that not only transformed America's military culture, but has impacted many other sectors in our society in ways that were probably unforeseen. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I'll try to. I think we as a people, have forgotten the fact that from the founding of the Republic through Vietnam, the citizen soldier provided the foundation of our military system. By and large, Americans in earlier times viewed with some suspicion what they called a standing army, meaning an army of professionals. And so the practice was to, in times of emergency, to raise up a citizen army necessary to respond to that emergency. So what we remember as the great victories in our past, preserving the Union by defeating the Confederacy or defeating Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan in World War II, those were wars fought and won by citizen soldiers. And those were wars in which the American people were themselves fully engaged rather than detached. What happened in Vietnam, as a consequence of Vietnam, a misguided and deeply divisive war, is that the American people abandoned that tradition of the citizen soldier. And Richard Nixon ratified that abandonment in the early 1970s when he ended the draft and announced that henceforth we were going to rely on what we've come to call the all-volunteer force. But the all-volunteer force is, in fact, that standing army that the founders of our republic feared. So the argument of the book is that if in the short term, you know, back in the 80s and in the 90s, one could see some merit in this professional force, soldiers were competent, no burden was imposed upon the American people, what we found, I think, since 9/11 is that there's a very significant downside. And it's the downside I described a minute ago of allowing the state to do what it wishes to in the realm of warfare, abusing American soldiers while we do nothing about it.
When you talk about in the book about the extended tours of duty that soldiers have served in Afghanistan and Iraq have undergone, which had no precedent in U.S. past wars, and what effect this has had on our servicemen, not only in terms of the more likelihood they're going to get wounded or killed, but in terms of post-traumatic stress, and then we have with the better equipment that they're wearing, protecting their lives, we have members coming back who've lost both arms, both legs, and will be permanently disabled. These are costs that the American public doesn't really hasn't come to grips with.
I think that's right. I mean, it's certainly not the case that in earlier wars that somehow service was easy. I mean, the soldiers suffered traumatically as a consequence of the Civil War, World War One, World War Two, Korea, and so on. But what we have in the present day is, I think, something even worse than you describe. What we have is a military system that's fundamentally undemocratic and, I think, immoral. Many commentators have noted that we are, for all practical purposes, have find ourselves in a condition of permanent war, open-ended war, and yet it's war fought by basically 1% of the population. The other 99% are not engaged, are not required to sacrifice. And I think that should stick in our craw. It's wrong.
Well, it's interesting that 1% you brought up in your book, there was the Occupy movement, which was focused on Wall Street and paid no attention to what was going on in Afghanistan and Iraq, obviously epitomized that because there was a 1% on both ends.
That's exactly right. I mean, if it is wrong, and I think it is wrong, for us to have a political economy in which the 1% end up controlling, what is it now, over 40% of the nation's total wealth, and that the 1% manages to prosper even in times of economic hardship, if that's wrong, and I think it's wrong, then it's equally wrong for the 99% of us who complain about the plutocrats. For the 95% of us who complain about the people who are getting rich, it's wrong for us to stand by and allow 1% of our fellow citizens to bear the burden of service and sacrifice in these wars.
Well, also some of that 1% profits from these wars as well, because as you point out in your book, not only do we have an all-volunteer army, but we have private contractors, all kinds of costs that have raised the cost of this war into the billions, trillions of dollars. And perhaps you could elaborate on those extra costs that
You know, war has always been a money-making proposition for some people. But what's occurred over the past decade is that it's become primarily a money-making proposition. And what I mean by that is this. Our reliance on a standing army that proved unable to win, as it was expected to win, in Iraq and Afghanistan, has found us involved in wars that were supposed to be short but ended up being very, very long. I mean, to put it simply, we ended up with too much war, too few warriors. And to fill the gap, to make up the difference, the government basically turned to private contractors, opened the door to a vastly larger contractor presence in the war zone than was the case in the past, meaning inviting in institutions that viewed war as a way to make money. And I think that this has resulted in, we know it has resulted in, vast corruption. And not an especially effective prosecution of the wars. So we do end up spending exorbitant amounts of money for no appreciable result.
Well, it's interesting. Had there been a draft, it's probably unlikely that either the Iraq War or Afghanistan War would have gone on as long as it had, because we could look back on 1971, when the draft was ended. Although a lot of people in the anti-war movement don't want to admit it, that was the end of the anti-war movement. And without a base of young men or young women, but young men essentially, who would be called to fight in a war, the anti-war movement against the Iraq War or Afghanistan War never got off the ground.
Well, yes, although I probably disagree with you a little bit in this sense, that it could have been that the people would have turned against the war. On the other hand, if the government could have made the case that winning in Iraq was a true imperative, then a system that relied on the citizen soldier would have made it possible for the government to generate a much larger army. Again, the abandonment of that of the citizen soldier tradition means that the government, the state, has very few tools if it finds that it has a need for a much larger military, because we, the people, have opted out.
Oh, well, there's another thing that you write about, how the National Guard and the Reserve which were supposed to be backups, have become essentially a part of the volunteer, quote, fighting force.
Well, they've become an adjunct to the regular force. I mean, the previous expectation was that guardsmen and reservists would be mobilized only in the event of an extreme national emergency, of a World War II type of event. But what we've seen since 9/11 is that elements of the Guard and the Reserves are routinely mobilized, so that they too take their place in this rotation in and out of the war zone.
One of the things, aspects I was bringing up about the lack of the draft is when during the Vietnam War there was resistance in the schools, there was draft counseling and so on. In one of the local high schools, when 1,500 Americans were died, I asked an 11th grade history class to tell me, any student could tell me, how many Americans had died in Iraq. And there were about 30 students in the class, and not a single student had any idea. It's a history class.
And this is an example of what happens when the people disengage. Disengage from their military, disengage from the wars that are being carried on in their name. And I'm not blaming those students. I think that's emblematic of the larger problem.
That will, it seemed to have been, that's probably one of the intents or the unintentional, the consequences of disengaging the public from the war, that they're not going to be, care so much about what's been going on in their name. And you point this out, particularly when you talk about the lip service paid to support the troops, when in fact, unless you have somebody in your family in the service or a friend who's serving overseas, the war is from your mind.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's that then that gives people in Washington a free hand to do what they want to do. Now, you know, if somebody listening to this program thinks that the Iraq War was a good idea, then allowing President Bush and his people to have a free hand might seem appropriate. But I'm in the camp that thinks that the Iraq War was unnecessary, that sees the Afghanistan War as having been badly mismanaged. And so I think that they shouldn't have a free hand in Washington.
You write about, and you've written in the past, as we have interviewed you before, and your books have a certain continuum. You write about America's need for enemies, and with the collapse of the USSR as a perceived threat, and people talked about a peace dividend that was not about to happen. Saddam came to the rescue going into Kuwait, and then the policy of preventive war over deterrence, the emergence of so-called rogue states, has kept this pot brewing. Perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Well, I think that you know, all institutions, not just military institutions, not just governments, all institutions want to perpetuate themselves, want to preserve their prerogatives, their status. And from that perspective, then the end of the Cold War was kind of a disaster for the national security establishment. The threat of a peace dividend viewed as a threat. And so there was an effort in the early 1990s to rethink the fundamentals of U.S. national security policy, to move away from the notion of deterring or defending against threats, and moving toward the notion that the projection of power in anticipation of threats could become the basis of a new mission, of a new approach to national security. And in some respects, the events of 9/11 enabled proponents of that idea to very much have their day. And you know, if any of your listeners would go back and take a look at the famous or infamous 2002 National Security Strategy published by the Bush administration, that's the key document, I think, in trying to put into basic policy this new approach to projecting power rather than simply being content to defend and deter.
Well, the global war on terror seems to be something that they want to maintain. And in the past week and a half, U.S. forces have kidnapped a wanted al-Qaeda suspect in Libya, failed to capture an al-Shabaab leader in Somalia, and kidnapped a former member of the Pakistan Taliban who had become an agent for the Afghanistan government, had been turned while he was traveling with a contingent of Afghan troops. And these kidnappings have drawn criticism on the U.S. from across what are nominally U.S. allies. And the failed effort in Mogadishu no doubt will serve as a recruiting tool for the Shabab. Do the people running the show in Washington know what they're doing, or is this their way of ensuring that the war on terror stays ongoing?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think I'd sort of narrow it to say, ask, does President Obama know what he's doing? Because what you described really is Obama's transformation of the war on terror. I mean, what Obama seems to have concluded, based on Bush's experience and his own experience in his first couple of years in office when he escalated the war in Afghanistan, I think Obama has concluded that invading countries is a bad idea. You get bogged down. The costs are great. The returns are small. Political consequences tend to be negative. And so instead of being in the business of invading and occupying countries, he's in the business of using drones and special operations forces to engage in these much smaller scale operations that are targeting individuals or relatively small groups. And you have to ask yourself, well, what's the long-term strategy here? How is relying on drones and SEAL Team 6 to go kill bad guys going to move us to a point where we can say we are now secure and this period of war is over? I don't see any strategic logic behind this. And there is the argument, which I think probably has merit, that every time we go violate the sovereignty of some state like Pakistan, or every time a missile goes slightly awry and we kill non-combatants, that the overall effect is to increase the number of people who are hostile toward us rather than reducing the numbers. So strategically, the Obama approach doesn't seem to make any more sense than the Bush approach.
Well, we seem to have done a great job in destabilizing Pakistan, which wasn't that stable to begin with. But even then, the Washington spokesman said, well, the government of Libya actually secretly endorsed the kidnapping of this former al-Qaeda official, or supposedly involved in a bombing in Kenya in 1998. It was done with the government's permission, the government of Libya, which of course then undermines this government of Libya, whether it's true or not, which we're supposed to be supporting. So it's kind of like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
Well, I'm not sure how much of a government there is in Libya at the moment. I mean, overthrowing Gaddafi was advertised as a great victory, but and I'm not speaking on behalf of Gaddafi by any means, but the consequences of doing so didn't result in democracy flowering. It resulted in something akin to chaos existing. So again, the unintended consequences that result from the use of force overwhelm the intended consequences, which would lead me, at least, to conclude that perhaps we are not wise enough to employ our military might in the Islamic world with any expectation that the larger outcome is going to be positive. We keep mucking around. We keep trying, hither and there and yon. We came within an inch of attacking Syria a couple weeks ago. But there's precious little evidence that our military exertions actually are producing positive effects.
Well, speaking of Syria, the sudden upsurge of popular opinion against the U.S. attack on Syria caught a number of people by surprise, and including myself, and both parties in Congress had to acknowledge that. And had Obama not been rescued by Putin, it seems obvious that he would have emulated Britain's David Cameron in losing a war vote in Congress. How did you interpret that episode? Is it possibly a harbinger of something better down the road?
Well, I think that's a good question, and I'll give you an unsatisfactory answer, that it remains to be seen. I mean, 10 years from now, I think it's possible that we will look back on the canceled attack on Syria as perhaps being a turning point. But I'm not sure we can say that right now. As you said a little bit earlier, since canceling the attack on Syria, Obama has ordered raids in Somalia and Libya. So was it a turning point? Don't know yet. It certainly was a remarkably interesting episode. I think the driver was that Obama foolishly drew his red line and then had to do something, felt he had to do something, when the red line was crossed, that is to say, when the Assad regime used chemical weapons. And yet, as the president then prepared to make good on his threat, he found that he was all alone. The Brits bailed out. Public opinion was negative. Congress wasn't going to sign up to it. And I think that in many respects, as even if it was kind of a comic episode, he's probably somewhat grateful to Putin for pulling his chestnuts out of the fire, because he was on the verge of starting another war, he, the president, when I think the president didn't want to start that war.
You know, we see the pressure from pro-Israel neocons, the same pro-Israel neocons who were blamed for the Iraq War, what Colin Powell later referred to as the Jinsa crowd, referring to the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, as being responsible for the war. And you illustrate how the public members of the intelligentsia, whose columns can be found in the mainstream media across the political spectrum, from the liberals to David Brooks and the right, the New York Times, jumped on the bandwagon from war without many second thoughts. And totalitarian state media couldn't have done it much better. Some of the same pundits are out there pushing for U.S. attack on Syria, and they're still pushing for a confrontation with Iran. They don't seem to have learned anything from what's happened.
Well, they don't. And, I mean, the argument I'm making in the book is that one of the reasons that they can so casually become proponents of yet another war is that they themselves really don't have any personal stake. I mean, that if we had a people who were more engaged with their military, if we had a military that was more reflective of American society, then I speculate, I guess, perhaps our elites wouldn't be so quick to want to pull the trigger, because the people they would be sending in harm's way would be people like themselves, which is not the case now.
Well, no, this term chicken hawk developed because we have a number of people who see the American soldiers as being pawns on a chessboard, which they delight to planning. They plan their moves to move them here and there, and without any cost, personal cost to themselves, and the public and their editors don't seem to have paid any cost themselves. There's hardly, other than the Nation magazine for national magazines, do you see any publication that is consistently anti-war, anti-militarism?
I think you're right. The American Conservative on the other side would be the other.
That's true.
That takes a principled sort of non-interventionist stand, or at least is skeptical of interventionism.
But you don't see their talking heads from the American Conservative as well on the talk shows.
That's for sure. Yes, you're exactly right.
I mean, I'm not a fan of Pat Buchanan. You mentioned him in the book. But Pat Buchanan's take on the Iraq War was from the very beginning. Whatever his motivation was, he was dead on from the very beginning.
Bingo. Exactly right.
Yeah. You write about other soldiers, officers like yourself, who once they've been freed from the constraints of the service may look back at what you've done, what they have done in that service with new eyes, and you cite Smedley Butler as one of the number of examples, most famous example. And yet, as you point out, their insights have not been warmly received by the media or the public, and you don't learn about them certainly in our public schools.
Well, my argument is that these guys, it would be great if these guys would announce their insights when they were still on active duty and could do something about it. The most recent example is General Stanley McChrystal, who until President Obama fired him, was a very prominent four-star officer and highly regarded, who in retirement now has announced that maybe the all-volunteer force isn't such a good idea. Maybe we need to have the American people engaged in wars that we undertake. And, you know, that his comments as a retired officer got a certain modest amount of attention, but not enough to make a difference. And my argument is that if he had said that when he was on active duty, that might have generated a very interesting and, I think, needed debate about our military system.
Or you talk about also the idea of young people having to do some form of national service to reinvigorate the concept of citizenship.
And to close the gap between the military and society. I mean, many of your listeners will know what national service means, that basically all 18-year-olds, if I'm just arbitrarily picking an age, owe some term of service to country and community, some of them doing that service in the military, others doing it in other capacities, you know, Peace Corps, Teach for America, protecting the environment, any number of things, but that everybody serves. And I think that would both reinvigorate our conception of citizenship and also give us a military that looked a little bit more like the rest of society.
You know, there's a touching story in your book, getting back to officers who had second thoughts. You write about a man, an officer named Theodore Westhusing, and he's one that should not be forgotten. I was not familiar with his name or his story. Perhaps you can tell us who he was and what happened.
Yeah, well,
to him.
Westhusing was a West Point graduate who actually ended up getting a PhD in philosophy and being assigned to the English department at West Point, where the focus of his teaching was the military profession, to which he was deeply committed to a code of principles that should provide the foundation for military service. He volunteered to go to Iraq in the middle of the Iraq War, and when he was sent to Iraq, he was assigned to basically supervise some of these contractors that we spoke of a little while ago. And what he found was a war that was corrupt, in which corruption, in a sense, had displaced professional values, and he was unable to cope with that. I mean, we don't know why he did what he did, but ultimately he took his own life. And I think that his death, his sacrifice of himself, ought to be a wake-up call to, particularly to people within the officer corps who believe in the military profession, but quite frankly, by extension, should be a wake-up call to the rest of us who should want to have a strong military profession that both gives us effective military forces and forces that are subordinate to civilian control.
Is there, given the present situation, is there a positive outlook that you could conclude with, because I know you have to have another appointment, the prospects, as you mentioned, we can, despite the not invading or bombing Syria, the other attacks around the globe, some of which we know about, some of we don't, are continuing. Is there anything that you could say to our listeners before we sign off that that they could do?
Well, I mean, I think insist on realism, insist on calling things the way they are. They're because of this, to my mind, fraudulent notion of supporting the troops, we've forfeited our ability to think critically about what U.S. military policy actually is achieving. I mean, are we making the Islamic world more stable? Are we making it more democratic? Are we making people who live in that part of the world more pro-American as a result of our exertions? I think the answer to those questions is no, no, and no. And therefore, if our policies aren't working, then we need to change our policies. And it's time for larger numbers of Americans to make that point to our elected representatives. And if enough of us make that point, maybe somebody will listen.
Well, Andrew Bacevich, I want to thank you very much for being our guest again on Takes on the World and for your another excellent book in the series you've been writing on American militarism. I think there should be required reading. I mentioned the last time I interviewed you that the last book I interviewed about should be required reading in our schools, and certainly this one as well. So again, thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye.